Okay, well, so first of all, thank you very much, Caterina, Angelica, and Davut for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here, to be outside the frameworks of the university where we are quite framed, although I try not to follow the rules as much as some of my my colleagues. But anyway, I'm very happy to be here. It's an opportunity for me to explain a little bit my philosophical investigation, basically. My philosophical goal is to basically follow what Michel Foucault called une ontologie de l'actualité, which is basically an idea that, well, philosophy is supposed to respond in some way, or it's supposed to give a response to the general condition in which we find ourselves. And by general condition in which we find ourselves, Michel Foucault did not specify precisely what that meant, but he didn't only mean the question of society in general, or in particular now, for example, the war we have, or the issues of emergencies we have, and all with the pandemic, but also to what is our condition today, what is our existential condition today, what does it mean in some way to, perhaps for some of you, to make art, or to be creators, or to simply be, let's say, more or less responsible citizens. What does it mean? What does it entail? And most of all, what does it require from us? What does all this situation require from us? So the title that I suggested after I talked with Caterina and Davut, Where is the Future? Warnings Through Art, have to do with, well, on the first idea is the problem of the future, which I think it's vital to understand that when we talk about future, at least in philosophy, we try to make a very sharp distinction between the future and what is coming. In other words, in French and in Italian, it's easier. Le futur et l'avenir. Il futuro e l'avvenire. These are two very different things. Unfortunately, many of us still think in terms of future. We shouldn't be talking about the future. The future is something that we want to predict, right? We want to know what will happen, and then we find ourselves in some sort of surprise of the pandemic or surprise of the war in Ukraine. Instead, when we talk about l'avenir, which is something that, of course, Jacques Derrida, a very important French philosopher you all know, has a lot of writings about l'avenir de la démocratie and l'avenir in general. So l'avenir, or what's coming, it's very useful in actually to explain and to be prepared in some way to those events we cannot explain backwards. In other words, it is very difficult for someone who predicts the future to explain an event, in other words, an Ereignis, in the German terms of the meaning, in other words, something that happened that you did not know it was going to happen. Instead, for l'avenir, people who work with this idea of the future as l'avenir, we tend to think more in terms of events. In other words, we have to be prepared for not necessarily new things that will happen, but probably things which are different. So this is where the subtitle of my talk today, which is basically what I'm working on now for my next book coming out next year, this idea of warnings. So warnings are very important today, and the three concepts I'm going to be discussing today, one is the idea of warnings, okay? The second one is the idea of emergencies. What is an emergency today, okay? Which is something that we all seem to have we all seem to be living in an age of emergencies, right? Because we have a terrorist attack, pandemic, refugee crisis. And I will explain that I do not think we're living at all in an age of emergencies, not at all. So that's my first provocation. The second provocation I hope to suggest is that, well, in order to, in some way, to save us, because the title of my book, the book that was mentioned before, Why Only Art Can Save Us, which is a book which has very little to do with art. Okay? It actually has much more to do with ontology, with what art means from a very general perspective. So, and basically the third point I want to make is, what does salvation mean? Okay, because salvation does not mean to be rescued from something, as opposed to what we normally think. So to begin with, the first thing I want to point out is this idea of emergency. Actually, I will start with the emergency because it explains, I think it gives a better idea, a general idea of the situation in which we find ourselves. I believe, following, of course, this is not things I come up with. This is all the work that comes from Benjamin, from Carl Schmitt, from Heidegger and other philosophers. But I'm sure you all remember, or you all know, Giorgio Agamben. Giorgio Agamben is a very important Italian philosopher. Unfortunately, the past year he went a little bit crazy with the pandemic. He doesn't really believe in it. But besides that, he wrote in 2003 his book Lo Stato d'Eccezione, The State of Exception, came out, which was a very popular book at the time, where he explains what the state of exception is. And he explained that through what George Bush was doing after the war in Iraq. So basically proposing a forcing a state of exception in order to change rules, to change the laws as he liked. So the idea was that after 9/11, we were living in this century, we were living in a condition where what determines democracy is the state of exception. So if we read now what happened since then, what do we have? We had 9/11, we had 2008, 2009 financial crisis, and we had now the pandemic, right? So three big events that many of us still think that these are a big event that actually change everything, right? That change the world. Well, my claim is that actually they did not change anything at all. And actually the only thing that changed after 9/11, after the 2008-2009 economic crisis, and after this pandemic, we are seeing this right now. And actually also the war now, it's a very good example I would also make. It did not really change anything. It really intensified some measures, democratic, technological, political, cultural measures that were already ongoing before. In other words, it's not that we didn't have any occupation in the Middle East before 9/11. Of course we had many. It shouldn't even be a surprise. We didn't have economic crisis before 2008, 2009. Had there been substantial reforms in order for another economic crisis not to occur, according to Thomas Piketty or Paul Krugman? No, there hasn't been any reform. On the contrary. And now after this pandemic, which by the way, it's nothing new, because if any of you were a little bit informed, or I think most of you were, at least you here, this pandemic has been announced for the past 15, 20 years by the World Health Organization, okay? The possibilities of a viral pandemic is something that was on the horizon all the time. It actually even occurred several times, and thank God it didn't expand all the way to becoming SARS, which is a very good example. In China, it was very serious. People were wearing masks back in the past 10 years. I remember being several times there, but everybody was wearing masks in Hong Kong and etc. So the idea is that, if these three events, the way I read them, and some other, I'm not the only one, of course, but the way these three events, if we read them now, okay, and actually to make a fourth event, since it's important to talk about the war as well, even this event, now that we have the war, I agree, we could not have predicted this the war coming up right away. Of course, we do know that Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, requested to Putin to start the war after the Olympic Games, because he wanted to have a nice inauguration. So that was already an indication that something was cooking there. But the NATO has been pushing it for too long. They have been pushing. If you look at the maps of the military bases throughout around Russia, it is quite scary. So he actually had discussion. Anyway, this invasion, which I do not support in any way, of course, we should be able to understand it, okay, from a more general point of view of the condition in which Russia finds itself. Okay, I'm not justifying it, but it is important to understand, at least in order not to repeat it in the future. Okay, so this invasion also is not such a big news, and the invasion that will soon take place in Taiwan, also from China, will also not really be a surprise, or at least it shouldn't be. Now, if we read all these four events, and because the amount of military equipment that the United States had been sending to Ukraine back in October should probably give us an idea that this was something that was going to happen, okay, also. So the point I'm trying to make is that what is the meaning of an emergency today? What is the meaning? How do we define emergency today? So Giorgio Agamben, he defined the emergency as, most of all, as something that takes place during a state of exception. And he had a very good example, right? We had a very good example of George W. Bush using, right, the invasion to use the state of exception in the United States. 20 years later, we have a better example, which more or less justifies my idea here, which is that the greatest emergency we have, I said greatest, okay? I didn't say only, okay? The greatest emergency we have is the absence of emergency. So the biggest emergencies we have are when there aren't any emergencies, when nothing really happens. Those are the greatest emergencies. So one, possibilities of terrorist attack. That's an absent emergency that becomes an emergency. Possibilities of a financial crisis. That's a great emergency that could happen anytime and that suddenly becomes an emergency. Or even the pandemic. This pandemic here was an absent emergency. In other words, an emergency that was not confronted properly. Okay, in Spain and in Italy, we find ourselves without masks the first 3 weeks, okay, because they were being produced somewhere else. So the idea is that an emergency that is not there, that we do not confront, like, for example, the possibility for a pandemic, is the greatest emergency that we have. And then it turns, it becomes a real emergency as we experience it now. So the idea, the thesis of the greatest emergency we have is the absence of emergency. It's a way also of saying that, it's not a way of saying that this pandemic is not something we should have confronted or we haven't confronted. I think it's great that we confronted it the way we did. Something could have been done better, but I'm no technician, I'm a philosopher, I only try to read the general ontological situation. But, for example, let's see another emergency that is not taken into consideration now. For example, air pollution. 7 million people die in the West of lung cancer due to air pollution. That's a little bit more than the whole coronavirus pandemic until now. And this is per year. So it seems to me, according to my ideas, that, and not only me, Owen Jones has a very nice article about this. As soon as the pandemic started, he wrote an article in The Guardian pointing this out as well. So maybe the idea of air pollution should be also an emergency we treat, okay? We confront the way we have been confronting other emergencies. So if we find ourselves now in a situation, or I think we do find ourselves in a situation where the greatest emergency is the absence of emergency, let's see if I also have an example like Agamben had. Not comparing myself to Agamben, I'm no one, but Agamben used W. Bush. I use Bolsonaro, Trump, et cetera, et cetera. Because if you read carefully, for Bolsonaro or for Trump, there was no emergency during the coronavirus. They literally neglected it. And they neglected so many other emergencies. Refugee crisis, Trump totally neglected it. Environmental crisis, completely neglected. So the idea now, I justify in some way this theory because there are a lot of politicians, but a lot of politicians, not only this right-wing populist, fascist populist, but also many, many leftists, unfortunately, who actually find themselves in a situation where they do not even need to declare the state of exception when an emergency takes place. In the United States, the state of exception was not declared during these past 2 years, okay? So this is something that should make us think, okay, carefully of where are, and this is my second point, where are or why don't we listen to warnings? Because warnings are there. We are being warned all the time, right? This is, if you read any newspapers, okay, and if you go through the newspapers, and in general, not only newspaper, also simple state announcement, there's a lot of warnings there. We warn you that climate change is continuing. We warn you that scientists warning us the whole time, right? This is not a very good example, but some of you probably, I make two examples. I used the bad one first. Netflix movie this Christmas, Don't Look Up. Some of you maybe have seen it. No, it's a funny movie, Leonardo DiCaprio, it's wonderful. It does make a point, right? These two scientists, they see a meteorite coming and it's definitely coming to hit the Earth, you know, and they warn us and nobody listens and the end of the world. Now, doesn't this happen the whole time? Because we're warned the whole time by a scientist about the climate change, okay? We are literally warned, and we're not only warned philosophically, like I am doing here with no authority whatsoever. They're actually doing it with very scientific and objective and whatever we like to consider our positivistic view of the world. They're actually explaining to us, okay, specifically what will happen if we continue this way. So we have been warned. We shouldn't be surprised of, again, the amount of people who die of lung cancer every year. We are warned, okay? So the problem here is that why don't we listen to warnings? There has to be a problem there. This is not only an issue about objectivity. Okay, this is not an ideological issue only. This is not only a question of, well, we don't, because when someone tells me, well, I don't want to get vaccinated, for example, I got vaccinated just for a question of trust. trust in institutions because I'm not a doctor, I haven't studied that stuff, so I just have to trust them, right, in some way. You have to trust them. So the question here for me, which is important to ask, is that why don't we listen to warnings, and how and who can help us begin to listen to them? Now, listening to warning is not very different from listening or interpreting those absence emergencies that I mentioned before. So warnings, in a way, there will be a pandemic, it's not very different from pointing out, well, an absence emergency we have, a great emergency we have that we do not confront, it's precisely the possibility of a pandemic. It's not very different, it's actually the same thing, okay? So why don't we listen to warnings, and who can help us listen to warnings given that science or scientists are incapable of doing it? Because we do have specific indications from scientists. Okay, if you read Naomi Klein's very interesting books about all these issues, she explains how if you go now to the greatest, to the big geological or scientist conference throughout the world, you would see that very few scientists even explain anymore their findings because they already found, they already explained everything. It's now they basically, the discussions they have are more political, more about how can we enact people to actually move, be moved, okay, be drawn by, okay. So the idea of warnings and the idea of who can allow us or help us to listen to them. This is what I'm very interested in. Now, in order to explain this, what can help or what actually helps and actually saves me as well is the idea of the philosophy, philosophical tradition that I practice, which is called hermeneutics. Philosophy of interpretation, okay, which has a very long history from Aristotle all the way to now Richard Rorty, to Zizek. And now I will actually quote a small passage from one of Zizek's recent books, most recent books, where he points out that we need to restore robust hermeneutical horizons to demonstrate how most things in the future will not depend purely on an accurate acceptance of data and scientific discoveries, okay, but on our own capacity to know how to interpret and manage their effects, looking into understanding what is really at stake. In other words, what Zizek is telling us is that what we need to do in order to listen to warnings, in order to listen to interpret our global condition today, is we need to return to what hermeneutics does. Hermeneutics has always, and this is the main hermeneutic philosopher here is Hans-Georg Gadamer, okay, and Paul Ricoeur, of course, and many others, but the idea is that, well, facts don't really exist. For hermeneutic philosophy, facts in themselves, okay, you probably all heard of Friedrich Nietzsche, right, and Nietzsche had this very famous, and he's one of our most important representative of hermeneutic philosophy. Nietzsche explained that there are no facts, he actually once said, there are no facts, there are only interpretation. So objectivity, it might be there, but it's not really that important. What is important is interpretation we give to it, okay? And if you look at the examples I just made now, you would see that interpretation is really what actually makes facts work, okay? So when Zizek here mentions that the future depends on our interpretation, okay? The future depends, okay, or most of all, I would say even L'Avenir, okay, depends on our capacities, okay, abilities, okay, and most of all, willingness, okay, because we don't want to interpret. Because the issue you have to ask yourself is, you know, what is the simple difference between, you know, description and interpretation, right? It's not the same thing, okay? A description has much to do with an idea that you just, in some way, represent as clearly as possible in your mind, and there's a whole long tradition in philosophy about this. The problem with that is that the way you represent things as clearly as possible become also the same things you're representing. Nothing really happens there, right? This is why Hans-Georg Gadamer insisted that Verstehen, understanding, only takes place when we understand differently. If we all understand the same way, well, nothing happened. I hope nobody understands the same way all the works of art here, right? Otherwise, it would be over very quickly. So what's more important is the effects the data has. For example, let's look at the example that all us hermeneutic philosophers, and maybe some of you already asked, planning to ask me this question that I always get asked, and we always get asked in order to get us into trouble. So what happens with facts? such as historical events, a genocide, maybe one like we had in the Holocaust, or maybe another one like the one taking place now in Palestine, whatever it is, an example, right? A fact that took place, or French Revolution. Now, so you guys don't believe in facts, so you don't believe in these events either. No. We do believe in those events. Actually, you believe in those events only because they have been interpretation of those events. In other words, facts alone, okay, and this is a quote now, one of the, I think it's the last book by Bruno Latour, facts alone, okay, so the virus alone, a genocide alone, a historical event alone, die. They don't sustain themselves. In order to sustain themselves, okay, in order to be understood, okay, you need more interpretation. They need to be sustained in some way. Okay? Facts alone, if nobody writes another history about the French Revolution, we will forget the French Revolution. Okay? So in order to keep the path open, you need more interpretation. Okay? You need to bring more to the event. Okay? So the idea here is that it's not that hermeneutic philosophers like Nietzsche or Heidegger would not believe in facts. No, the thing is that facts alone are not enough. And they are not enough because I just pointed out how we've been warned about so many events that took place and will others take place. For example, what is the greatest emergency we face today? The greatest emergency we face today, which is an absence emergency, okay, is probably a nice blackout of the internet connection for a couple of weeks. Okay? Such a serious that could actually very easily happen, okay, through hackers, through maybe a few governments that decide to close their connection, that would probably create many more deaths than the coronavirus, many more. I mean, it wouldn't be even in comparison with that. So the idea here is to understand that in order to not necessarily prevent, because we don't really need to prevent, but we can prepare, right? We can prepare for events that will probably take place, okay? That most likely will take place. And now my final point, because I have 7 minutes, I am very specific with my timing. So my final event is, so who can help us interpret, who can help us listen to warnings? Who is able today to do that? Because it seems to me that science alone is not capable of doing it. Science alone is not able to do it. And now you can discuss, we can discuss later, I hope we will discuss later. So the idea here is that according to Heidegger, philosophy must awaken the danger. Okay, our goal, the goal of philosophy in general, but not only philosophy, of course, also science, and science also does that when they point out the situation in which we find ourselves if we continue to ignore the climate change in which we are. So how do we get closer to the danger? And who is able today to get us closer to the danger in such a way that the danger also affects us, touches us? In other words, involves us in an intervention that does not simply concern, it concerns us, it concerns our avenir. Okay? So the question is, how can we be involved? Now, my claim is that, of course, now in this particular moment, okay, or at least if you look at some, I'm not an art historian, I don't want to be an art historian, I'm not a curator, I don't want to be a curator, so I'm only interested in how art can allow you, okay, can allow the absence of emergency to, which is a word that comes from emergency, to emerge. Okay? How can the absence of emergency emerge, okay, from its absence? Okay? Well, I think that there are many realms, okay, where this takes place. One place, of course, is philosophy. Another place can also be science. Another place can also be art. Now, given the situation that philosophy and art and science find themselves today, okay, if we look at philosophy, unfortunately now in contemporary philosophy, there's this whole new thing which is not new at all. Nothing new happens in philosophy, never, okay? So every time someone sells you a new philosophy, discard it because it's nothing new. So, and there are now a number of philosophers who talk about new realism or speculative ontology. This is nothing new, first of all. And second of all, it's interesting to read this because the new philosophers that announced this sort of return to reality, we have to return to reality against postmodern philosophers who created alternative facts and all this stuff. So. There's a number of philosophers there, Marcus Gabriel in Germany, here in Italy, Maurizio Ferraris, in France, Quentin Millasou. All these guys, they think that, well, we have to come back to reality, come back to things in themselves, okay, which is basically something that Husserl already worked on at the beginning of the last century, because this will save us in some way. Okay? Now, if we read carefully, all these new philosophers, which are not new at all, again, but they were very good in marketing because a lot of people fell into it, they all began at the beginning of the century also. So they began with what? With a very big return to order, retour à l'ordre, okay, that took place at the beginning of this century after 9/11. So when I say that after 9/11, 2008, 2009, financial crisis, and the pandemic, nothing really changed, but what did change is an intensification of the things that were already taking place, okay? Well, this is the return to reality they want to. Because if you read carefully, a hermeneutic philosopher, or a postmodern philosopher, which is not necessarily the same, but they're very close, we are definitely, certainly not responsible of alternative facts or post-truth. On the contrary, the only one who believes in alternative facts or post-truth is someone who has the truth. So it is Trump who says, oh, I know there is no climate change. In order to accuse someone of being of fake news, well, you have to have the news, right? You literally have to have it. You have to have a sort of rationality that works all the time. Okay? But unfortunately, that rationality, okay, has been deconstructed all the way because people like Sigmund Bauman, pointed out very clearly, rationality leads directly to Auschwitz, okay? Leads directly to a social condition, okay, where the possibility of freedom is very, very limited, okay? It's very, very close. So the idea here is to understand that hermeneutic philosophy can help to interpret the absence of emergencies we have. But who can help hermeneutic philosophers, or who can help us in general, or why do I claim in this book why only art can save us, which is a question, it's not a clear statement. But the idea is because, well, some contemporary art, and I think I have in the book, I make 12 examples, I think, and there are many more I could make. I wanted to make some from the show We Are the Tellers, but I will. I don't want to quote one and not quote the other, so I won't do anything. But there are many examples of this. For example, I'm sure that some of you know the work of, let's see, there's this Brazilian artist called Nelly Azevedo, that she creates small statues of ice, of men, so a man in a small statue of ice, and she creates like 2,000 of them, and she brings them in squares throughout Europe, and everybody helps her put them down, and they dissolve right there, okay? So she's clearly making a very clear statement about the problem we have with the glaciers melting. But that's not all. For example, Filippo Minelli, he had this very huge amount of work with big social media names, Twitter, Facebook, and he paints all this huge, the word Twitter, and he has 100 turkeys, one identical to the other, walking around, so that's basically us using social media. So there are a number of artists who push us, okay, into this absence of emergency. In other words, these issues that we do not confront, okay? Now, how are we supposed to read the relationship between these works of art, which are, for me, are only, that's why I always say that I don't really care about the artists, okay? I do care about the works of art, okay? The works of art, and a really good artist should be more interested in his work or her work rather than in them. So the idea here is that some of these works of art allow the emergency, the absence of emergency, to emerge. But what they're doing, and this is the main point I think that one should make, is that today what is vital is not to be rescued from emergencies. Today what is vital is to be rescued into emergencies, to be rescued into absent emergencies. In other words, emergencies such as climate change, which is not taken seriously, possible pandemics coming probably from Siberia, which is the most likely place where to come. So in other words, those we need to be rescued into those emergencies we do not confront. And the reason why we should be looking into, in particular, I think, art, and in particular some contemporary art or some others, is because truth, and I've been asked to talk about truth, and I will finish with the idea of a concept of truth, because truth, okay, objective truth, or in general truth, okay, alone, just like facts, does not work. Okay, it is not enough. Okay, truth, in order to function, has to be moved. It has to move us in some way. Okay, it has to change us in some way. So when Hans-Georg Gadamer talks about the idea that an aesthetic object, okay? An aesthetic object. Most of us always think in works of art when we imagine aesthetic works. Works of art. Aesthetic object for Gadamer and his wife is totally useless. It is much more important to try to interpret or try to see a work of art as an ereignis, an event. Why an event and not an aesthetic object? Because an event is something that will change all the time and will change all the time. This is why Gadamer pointed out that a great classic, for example, Picasso, Shakespeare, Red Hot Chili Peppers, whatever we want, a great classic, okay? Shakespeare or Dante, not far from here. He's a classic, or it is a classic, not because of the source, in other words, the truth or the fact. No, it is a classic because of the effects it continues to have throughout history. Okay? The effects it continues to have, and actually there's a better word than effect, which is consequences, because consequences has a negative connotation in English. So it is the consequences that it continues to have a certain amount of consequences that basically changes us all the time. And different generations read different things there. So the basic idea here is to understand that, and I finish now, because I'm 5 minutes over my allotment. So my main point is here is to, so where is the future? So that was my question at the beginning. Well, the future, most of all from a topological point of view, and topology means basically the space, the place where it happens, right? So where is the future? Well, the future takes place in those warnings, okay, that are given to us through art, okay? Because art managed to have a stronger impact in our emotions rather than in our rationality. And why is it so important to think more or to be more concerned for our emotion than our rationality? Because the rationality is not enough, like I already said. It is not enough. Science is not enough today to explain why we should all stop the cars right now. Otherwise, many of us, unfortunately, none of us, but some of us might have lung cancer given the amount of the quality of the air. So it is a question of being moved. Now, to close my example and to finish, because otherwise I would continue, why does Greta Thunberg have more impact than any of the scientists that you probably don't even know the names around? So Hansen, which is probably the most important scientist that deals with climate change, we hardly know him. But why does Greta Thunberg have so much more impact? Now, it is not a question of she has maybe some manager. That's not the issue. The issue is that her image, okay, her presence, okay, of a little girl, touches us much more, okay? We believe much more in her, okay, than in the scientist that actually probably constituted what she believes or conditioned the way she sees things. So when I ask, when I write here in my book that, well, only art can save us, or why only art can save us, I am asking, so, well, mostly because science is not enough to change us. It's not enough to move us, and that's why truth, okay, is a consequence of interpretation, rather than an origin of objectivity. Thank you.